to Motopod, the internet radio show all about motorcycle road racing. This is episode number 667. On the show, we'll be covering the Styrian Grand Prix from Austria in the Red Bull Ring. But to help me talk about all of the race action that happened this weekend is directly from the UK, Rich. Rich, what's going on over to UK tonight?
Yeah, good, thanks, Jim. Been out buying motorbikes today, although not for myself, regrettably, but for my mate Andy. So he's bought himself a nice Triumph Sprint GT today. So I'm in full-on jealousy mode at the moment.
I'd like to be saying that I could actually go buy some new motorcycle, but I don't particularly like any of the new ones. I've got to the point now where I think I want to start to have ones that I couldn't have when I was a kid. So at the top of the list is a Honda RC30, the red, white, and blue one from 1990.
Better get saving.
Yeah, they're not cheap. They're like, I did see a couple that were 10,000 US, so not horrible. Not horrible. Alrighty, folks. If you guys like the show and you want to help out, you can by going to our webpage, www.motopodcast.com, and throwing a little bit of money in the hat. There are PayPal and Patreon links for all of that. Just want to give a shout out to everybody who's been donating on Patreon and all of our regular supporters. You guys, we could not do the show without you, so we very much appreciate it. If you could go over to iTunes, give us a review so we can find more people to listen to the show, that would be helpful as well. With that, I think we shall move on to the news. First piece of news, Rich. Does Max Biaggi have a deal with Aprilia for a MotoGP team? The paddock seems to think that this is a done deal.
Well, I have to say it's a little bit of a new one on me, but it makes an awful lot of sense given Max's history with that particular manufacturer. I suppose the immediate question that comes to my mind is, will that require Dorna to put another two slots onto the grid? Because it's not immediately obvious to me where that team would slot in terms of current occupants, because I think the current... I can never pronounce it correctly. The Esperama.
What's the Esperama? Yeah, something like that.
The Ducati. That becomes the VR46 team, fully fledged, I believe, next year, doesn't it? It's kind of half that at the moment. So, yeah, where else would Max Biaggi get, two grid slots from?
Well, I think he gets them from Gresini, because it was Gresini Aprilia MotoGP team. I think it just now becomes Max Stelgrada Max Aprilia team.
Okay, but they've signed with Ducati. I mean, I don't know how long that deal is for, so maybe that's just a holding position.
Who signed with Ducati?
For them.
Who signed with
Ducati? I'm sure Gresini have run Ducati, because the word was, or the belief was, I think, they would go with Aprilia, given that they've been running that bike, which is going to go to a fully fledged works team. So, yeah, maybe that would be the place for it to happen.
I think it's probably they add those seats, because I think it's Aprilia's factory. So I don't think Dorna's going to say no to him. I just think it's going to be, as much as what Gresini ran the factory team, I think Max just runs the factory team. I also think he is an Italian. There's another Italian that's got a Moto3 team and a MotoGP team. And I think this Italian wants to have a MotoGP team and a
Moto3
team.
Well, that would make sense. Yeah, for him to head up and be the kind of the figurehead, I suppose, of the works team would make a lot of sense. And I suppose with Rossi doing a similar thing, being the figurehead, is going to be a draw, because I'm sure there's still quite a lot of people out there that remember the early 2000s and the rivalry between those two guys.
And yeah, I think to have that rivalry between teams would be fun.
That'd be awesome.
Yeah. All right, let's move on. The second thing in the news here, Morbidelli will move to the factory Yamaha squad and partner Quartararo. I don't think this is not earth shaking. There was nothing crazy about it. I think it was just expected.
Yeah. I think now that, particularly now that Raz Gathioglu has committed himself to World Superbikes, from what I read, turned down that ride, or one of the Yamaha rides anyway, possibly with the Petronas team. But yeah, I suppose that clears the way really for Morbidelli, who on merit should be on that bike, in my opinion.
Yeah, I agree. I think Morbidelli's earned it. He's done his journeyman work on a couple-year-old M1. So I think him and Quartararo were somewhat magical in the Petronas team when they were together. I think they feed off each other, and I think they tend to ride or have a similar setup to the motorcycle. So you're pushing in the same direction. So it'd be interesting to see what happens there in the team. Darren Binder of Moto3 fame, Petronas Sprinter Racing, looks to be getting ready to jump over Moto 2 and go right to the MotoGP team, taking one of the Petronas Sprint to Yamaha M1s.
I have a funny feeling this might actually happen. I mean, it's not without precedent in terms of Miller,
Correct.
Jack Miller, having done it a few years ago. I'm a little bit skeptical about it in one sense, because I mean, Darren Binder's been a pretty solid performer in Moto3, but he hasn't exactly set the world on fire this year. He's had some bad luck, I think it would be fair to say, but it would be a big jump, but it can be done, as we've seen with Jack Miller.
Well, I think one, there's the Miller precedent. Miller did do it, but Miller was much younger when he hopped over. Darren is 23, so he's a fairly big lad for a Moto 3 bike. I think he will do okay on it, but it is going to be interesting just to watch what happens as he tries to get to grips with a Moto GP bike, having no prior intermediate class experience in there. But
I suppose the other point, as you just pointed out, Jim, as well, is that given he's a little bit older than a lot of his contemporaries in that Moto3 class, he kind of needs to make the jump to MotoGP rather than spending 1 or 2 years in Moto2, because he might just find that ship set sail and he misses his chance.
yep, I agree. Raul Fernandez will ride for KTM Tech 3 in Moto GT and the Moto GT. One more time in English for the Moto GP team next year. He was asked point blank if he was happy about it, and he said no. The kid seems like he wants to stay in Moto 2. I can't say that I blame him. He did come on strong in the class. He is definitely a talented person, but he has, in the last few races, I think, kind of lost his way a little bit, and he's just made some silly errors that far be it for me to judge whether he could or couldn't do it on a Moto GP bike, but I think he knows he needs to season up a little bit more. But I think KTM is also a little tired of seeing their talent walk out the door. I give you one, Jorge Martin. I think that the KTM boys were definitely going to move him whether he wanted to or not. And depending on how his contract is written, he's not really going to have too much of a say about what he is riding, because I'm assuming his contract is just simply with KTM and not specifically with Tech 3.
Yeah, it's a curious one. I mean, I'm no contract law specialist by any means, but it is a little bit curious that because I think it was Matt Burt, or what, anyway, one of the Dorna commentators over the weekend when this news came out, which I think was during MotoGP free practice 4, the news suddenly broke, and this notion that he's not particularly happy about it, which I kind of get. I mean, I think it's a little bit soon to move him up in one respect, but KTM have such a conveyor belt of talent coming through that they're sort of struggling to keep hold of people. I suppose is a nice problem that they have, but I wouldn't have thought it would have been beyond the bounds of possibility just to renegotiate his existing contract to say one more year in Moto2 with KTM and then move up. But what the Dorna guys were saying was that at the end of next year he becomes a free agent, and then he would be liable to get snatched by probably Yamaha or one or two other factories that would quite obviously be sniffing around. So it was a little bit weird the way that kind of played out over the weekend. And Hervé Poncharal was clearly pretty disgruntled with that press release that came out seemingly without his prior knowledge, which is a bit extraordinary. But clearly KTM's hand was forced by Yamaha and Aprilia, I think, trying to get a signature on a piece of paper.
Yeah, it was definitely weird that they announced it in the middle of free practice 4, and I think Hervé was upset that he didn't get a chance to sit down with both of his riders and explain to them the situation. I would, I, come on, if you were Petrucci or Lecuona, I think you could see the writing on the wall. Petrucci even said that in an interview. But still, I think there's a right way to go about doing it and a wrong way to go about doing it, and quite honestly, that was the wrong way.
The poor old Lecuona, literally within about 60 seconds of that tweet coming out with the press release, Lecuona crashed, which was just a sort of a sad tale.
I think Lecuona goes back to Moto 2, and I'm wondering if he doesn't partner Fernandez at IO. I'm
Yeah.
just I I kind of see that happening, but I'm not the guy who runs the contracts, nor do I know contract law either, right?
That you've got a little problem in the shape of Pedro Acosta.
Right, that's right. Because Pit Beyer does not know what to do about Pedro Acosta. He has stated that he thinks he might be a bit too young to put him on a Moto T bike. I can't disagree, considering the conversations we've had in a prior podcast about that. But what does Acosta have to prove in that class? If he has come in as a rookie, has break basically he has a 50% win rate. Pretty close,
Yeah.
right? What does he have to prove in that class? Really nothing. You came in, you beat the best in the world, and you are a world champion. You sort of move onward and you go to the next place. Now, he doesn't have to light the world on fire in Moto2. He doesn't have to win a Moto2 championship, but hey, again, there's this conveyor belt at KTM. They have all this talent, and they're finding and mining for more. They have to figure out where they're going to put everybody.
Yeah, I can't see any scenario in which he stays in Moto3 next year unless something crazy happens in the run out of this season and through injury or some strange change of fortune, he doesn't win the title. But he's got a over a 2-race lead in the points, I think it is now. So yeah, I just can't envisage any scenario where he's not in Moto2 next year. And equally, I can't envisage a scenario where he's not in the IO team in Moto2.
Yeah, I can't figure it out either. The Red Bull Ring in Austria has given us some great racing, given us some great moments, and gave us some potentially horrendous moments. So there's a lot of talk that happened after this weekend's events, which we'll talk about during the race when we review the MotoGP race, that there should be a chicane added to the straightaway that's between turns one and turn three, which there is a turn two there, but it's just a bend in the road that's flat out. There was a bunch of talk of that on Twitter. David Emmett has it on his page, I think, as well. What is not clear to me is whether or not this would be implemented before the race this coming weekend. It sounded as though they were trying to do something for this weekend, but I don't think it's possible, to be honest.
No, I mean, you may recall back again, without wishing to stray too far into Formula One, but in '94 there were a sudden rash of kind of just almost like bollards in the road kind of chicanes that popped up to slow certain dangerous parts of track as it was seen at the time. So I mean, I suppose they could do kind of a sticking plaster
Yeah.
solution like that, but I mean, I don't like chicanes, but far be it from me. I mean, the riders even before last year, when the Red Bull Ring came onto the calendar, people were pointing to turn three as a troublesome place given the speed at which they arrive at that corner. And obviously last year proved what could potentially go wrong. Although they have now properly extended that protection wall and catch fencing across to try and catch any errant bikes that might go there in the future. But I suppose a chicane looks likely, although I do think it would be a shame, because it would really interrupt the flow of the track. I mean, I don't think it's a great track. I don't think many of the riders particularly love it, unless they're Ducati riders, because it tend or historically has played to the strength of the Ducati. Although, arguably, that those days are over as well now. So, yeah, let's see what happens. But I think it would be a shame. But safety has to come first.
Yep. On the back of what we were talking about being too young to race a bike and the whole Moto3 problem, Jürgen van der Gerberg, who was a Moto2 rider and a 500 rider, and I think he retired from the sport in 2005, at least that's what I read in Matt Oxley's article on this, says that the way to solve the pack racing that we see in Moto3 is to change the gear ratios in the bikes. His son is racing in the some high national series. I don't remember which one it was, and I couldn't pronounce it anyway if I had to. But he says that in Moto3, fifth and sixth gear are actually basically like overdrives in Moto3 bikes, to where if you change from fifth to sixth, nothing really happens, but you have a lot of extra rev area so that as you're getting towed along in the draft, you can go faster. And that's why everybody has to have a tow, why everybody's trying to be in a draft with somebody. But by changing the rules and saying that like the maximum difference between ratios by mile per hour has to be only say 10 or 12 kilometers per hour, then you're going to eliminate the, you'll have ability for one guy to get out front, sort of stay in front and kind of have that chance to break the draft, as opposed to just having everybody go blowing by at Mugello or Barcelona or at the Red Bull Ring. So it's an interesting thought. It's an interesting idea. It really doesn't take anything to do other than just have the engineers say you can't have these ratios.
Yeah, I mean, we mustn't retread, you know, a long conversation last week, but, you know, I think we identified that really the problem is there's still a lot of riders in a pack. I don't really quite see how that would solve, you know, large packs. It might slow the bikes down and perhaps it could break the field up a little bit. I mean, my mechanical knowledge is not strong enough to really have a clear opinion on that. But, well, something needs to be done. I think we talked this one through last week fairly comprehensively and something needs to be done.
Yep. Something. So anything's better than doing nothing. And yeah. The final piece of news, there's this some guy named Rossi has agreed to retire at the end of the season. Not sure if you've ever heard of him, Rich.
Yeah, name does ring a bell.
Yeah. It was about time, I think.
Yeah. Did you watch the extraordinary press conference they called it on Thursday?
I did. I watched the condensed version of it. It was, I don't want to, emotional is not the right word, but it was definitely heartfelt. That's more what I would say.
It was done with, you know, good grace, humor, and humility, right, which you kind of expect a little bit from Rossi, don't you? And very pragmatic, actually. I thought, you know, he clearly gave a lot of serious thought towards jumping onto that Ducati next year. But, you know, he made the point that he felt himself it would take him much more than one season to get to grips with that bike and be fast. And then, you know, he's just getting even older. And I think probably from his point of view, he knows that he's denying a younger rider and more particularly one from his own academy, the chance to jump on that bike and do a, you know, the sorts of things that we saw from Jorge Martin this weekend. So I think it's the right decision. It's a shame, but he's not going to be completely gone from the paddock. So yeah, I think it was the right call. Possibly a year or two later than perhaps would have been ideal because he's really struggling and it's not nice to see him riding around at the back.
No.
But it's going to be a, you know, a fanfare last half a season, so we should enjoy it whilst we've still got the chance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, at least now he has the ability to have some fans in the stands to see him off, and I think that's good. The arguments will now then begin, is he the greatest of all time? And that depends on how you're going to put your metrics down. As to it, is he one of the greatest that has ever thrown a leg over a motorcycle? Far and away, yes. Is he absolutely the best? Maybe. I can make a strong argument for the not. I can also make a strong argument for the four. But it was just time to call it on a career. I will say this about Rossi. No other person has raced quite the plethora of motorcycles at that high of a level as what he had. And to succeed, and he succeeded on basically them all, to be quite honest. And along the way, he pretty much reinvented his riding style by my count three times, which is fascinating. So,
yeah. I think his greatest contribution in a funny sort of way, Jim, as well. And I don't know if you saw the tweet that, of all people, Jorge Lorenzo put out, which I thought was really beautiful. I mean, he really, I think, accurately described Rossi as the, you know, the Muhammad Ali, the Serena Williams, you know, that transcending kind of character that was bigger than the sport and brought, you know, the wider public awareness to the sport. And for that, you know, Dorna could never pay him enough money, really, because, you know, the following that he has and will continue to have for years to come. I was looking forward to going to MotoGP at Silverstone in 3 weeks before, and I'm even more looking forward to it now because it's going to be a massive festival.
Oh, yeah.
Because, you know, it's the last chance to see Rossi race on British soil.
Yep. So, I mean, for me, I think there was a time when MotoGP needed Rossi, and now Rossi pulled them through a very lean time, and now they're in a very good position that he can safely walk away and the sport will continue. So that's how I'm going to leave it with my opinions on Rossi. Let's talk about the racing. Let's go through it from the early morning Moto 3 race to the final race of the day, which is Moto GP. And I want to do it that way, guys, just because of the fact that it was raining and all that plays into what happens during the day. But let's look quickly at qualifying for Moto 3. In the first Moto 3 qualifying session, Suzuki, Fanati, Rodrigo, Artigas, Toba, and Foggia were all in that first session, which gives you to show you just how close it actually is with everyone. I was amazed that everyone sort of sat in the pits until about 8 minutes to go, and then the fast guys came out all in a pack. And then from there, we got Foggia, Suzuki, Rodrigo, and Fanati all going into the all-important Q2 session for it. That session was pretty interesting as far as, like, you had Antonelli, who was down at turn 10. Garcia was down at turn 3 with a high side after he had put himself on pole. And I wasn't sure who was going to get pole because there were still guys that were making fast times, but were they past the yellow flags or were they in the yellow flags? And I thought for sure that maybe Garcia had gotten pole and then threw it away only to still be on pole. But no, there's this kid named Anshu who blew in with an incredible lap to show up with the pole. And what was interesting, it was really pretty much without the aid of a big draft. He was pretty much on his own for that most of that lap to do it. And the other thing that was interesting about qualifying was there was no dawdling around. Everyone sort of got on with the job. No one was having a problem being on the racing line or dawdling when they shouldn't have been. And it was like, what happened in 5 weeks that made the Moto 3 guys behave?
I think they must have been listening to this podcast because nobody mistimed a lap. Nobody missed the getting across the line with a few seconds to go or no seconds to go, as we have previously seen on multiple occasions. Yeah, no, it was, as you say, it was a completely different kind of Moto 3 qualifying session. Astounding, really, but good to see. As you say, Fanati was another one who I noted down was out there just doing fast laps all on his own. And so he made it through Q1 doing that, and had a pretty strong Q2 as well. So yeah, that was good to see.
Yep. So the first three rows wound up like this. It was Anshu with his first career pole on a KTM, Garcia on a Gas, which is a KTM, Fanati, which was on a Husqvarna, which is a KTM. Then you had Acosta on his KTM. Then Guevara, Foggia, Masia, Darren Binder. And then Jeremy Alcoba filling out your front three rows. Foggia was the fastest Honda. We've always seen the lay-apart Hondas be really fast, but I thought it was strange to see all the KTMs in front there, because it wasn't until you got down to Foggia in sixth before you had a Honda. So KTM's new bike is definitely quick.
Yeah.
On Sunday morning, it rained, and the warm-ups were all in the wet, but the track was starting to dry. There was no sun to help it dry, but when the Moto 3 race began, there was wet, but there were drying lines that were appearing, mostly on the uphill run to turn one. There was a drying line. You had a drying line sort of through the 6-7 complex, and then there at 9 down into 10. Again, it's all downhill, right? So the water's going to run off the track. The big question was going to be, who on earth was going to go onto, or the big question was, who was going to start on wets, who was going to start on dries, or on slicks, basically. Now, looking at it, it was hard to say what was going to go on. A lot of people thought it was going to rain again. Some people didn't. But there was like seven guys who wound up starting on slicks. There was Anshu, Binder, Rodrigo, McPhee, Mino, Slash, Istihar, and Foggia all opted to go to slicks. Now, the interesting thing is our pole sitter, Anshu, they decided to go to slicks after the 3-minute board had been posted. That's a no-no. He was taken off the grid and had to start from pit lane. Big mistake by the KTM boys there on that one.
Yeah, gutted for him, really. Particularly, I know there were two races in Austria again last year as well, and I can't remember if it was the first or second of the races last year, but you may recall that Anshu was having a very good race in one of those and then managed to wipe out his teammate. So not happy memories for that young boy, I'm afraid, at this particular track. And he was kind of done, really, with that pit lane start.
Yep. Our championship leader Acosta, Garcia, Fanati, those, you know, they were all the guys that were going to be there at the beginning. When the lights went out, it was basically a race with Acosta and Garcia going to the lead. They were on the wets, and the run from turn one down to turn three was very wet. There was a lot of spray coming off the bikes. The question, we know that the Dunlap Moto3 tires will last for quite some time in the West. They're kind of a harder wet. And again, the Moto3 bikes don't have a lot of torque. They're not going to spin the tire up. They're not really going to chew that tire. But the question was going to be, how long was it going to be before you had that time frame when it's a switchover, right? When the guys are on worn wets aren't going as fast as they can because it's gotten dry and they've used up the wet tire. And then it's now dry enough that the slick tire has decided to come on and get heat. And you just didn't know where it was going to be. So that was the whole thing, was you're going to be watching this. But the interesting part at the beginning, it was just Acosta and Garcia and how they were racing each other. And what I noticed almost immediately was Acosta was going to the places where there was water almost instantly. It was not three or four laps in, and Acosta was looking for water. And I'm thinking, this kid does not miss a trick anywhere from the playbook. He knows that he's got to go the distance on those tires. So the sooner he gets to the wetter side of the track and keeps those tires as cool as he can, the longer that tire is going to last on his bike. Which, you know, again, this is a kid who in my mind has the entire full package. He thinks everything through and doesn't really miss a lick. And in the other part of it was in the beginning of the race, he let Garcia set the pace. Always a good thing in wet, if you have someone to work from in front of you, you can see where they brake, you can get a feel for how much they can apply the brakes and how much grip that there is going into a particular corner. The other thing about that was it left those two guys simply out front in their own little draft, and they were able to pull away from everybody else. They had made a gap early on in the race. It was definitely interesting. On Chu had started from the pit lane on the slicks. He was trying to come through. He was 20th after about three laps. Again, by lap 19, which is four laps into the race, Acosta was looking for the water. Again, pulling, I think, what was going to be a great strategy. But they were all pulling away from, like, Fanati. Binder was into the 45s, and the leaders were running 44. So about six laps into the race, we were getting close to that transfer point where we're still a second slow on slicks, but we're closing in. Binder was getting faster the whole time. But Binder rides so hard, he could put that energy into the tires to get it to be workable at that time. So it really, really now was starting to become a really interesting part of this. It's like, okay, what you know, when are we going to get this? Well, as soon as we did that, the boys in the front, led by Acosta, now got by Garcia, and so he tries to up the pace. I thought, ooh, okay, we're gonna go. I saved my tire. I kind of been looking at the pack. I've been looking at my pit board to see who's where and if they're coming, and I think I can go faster. Let's see if you can too, Garcia. Well, Garcia said, sure I can, and he went back right with him again. So it kind of became for a few laps a little back and forth between it, and that was they were still turning a good lap time, but now Binder was going about equal to what they were, but they had a 12-second lead. So yeah. It was how many, you know, we were down to like about, I'll say eight laps or so, but Binder was going to have to start picking them off like at about a second lap, which he did not have that pace in him. But with like four laps to go, we had Binder up to seventh, and it was going to be, could he get to a podium? That was what you were looking for, was could Binder actually get all the way to the podium? But at the end, Acosta makes a couple moves on Garcia, but Garcia would go back by again. Then they get on the last lap, they have a good run at it, and they pass each other a couple times. They're getting through 6 and 7, and that transition, Pedro Acosta was brutally quick through that section. He has all the faith in the front, was able to run a tighter line somehow through it, and was able to carry that speed out to that short, I think it might be slightly crested, uphill straight going into 9. And when they got there on the last lap going into 9, Acosta made the move to go 9. He was looking at moves at 6 and couldn't make it because Garcia was riding defensively for it. But as they went into 9, Garcia loses the front and he's gone. And it was like, next thing there, they shut, the camera angle changes, and we see Acosta running wide into the green, and he goes on to take the victory. I'm like, oh no, track limits. Are they going to bust him for track limits, right? Yeah, that's where the question becomes. And then there's enough time for Garcia to actually get up. I think he got lucky. I think the bike was still running. And he took off, and he actually finishes second in this. And then it's like, well, what's going to happen? Are they going to take a penalty away from it? And they never did. They never did take the win away from Acosta. If you go back, if you have the access to watch the race again in some manner, go back and watch, because going into 9, Acosta almost loses the front as well. He had it tucked hard, and I think he saved it off the elbow a la Marquez. Yep. And it's not hard to see, but it is definitely, you can see it because your focus is on Garcia, but you got to focus on the KTM, and you'll see that. And that's what caused him to run wide. And then that's a good call by the officials to say, hey, he was pushing it, he had to recover, and he went off.
I think there are two factors on that one, Jim. I think the first one is that Garcia fell off on his own accord. There was no contact between them. It was a tough move by Acosta into turn 9, and he had been practicing that move lap after lap after lap. You repeatedly saw him sitting up, coming over the crest of that hill and down into turn 9. So he was practicing that repeatedly. But I think the more telling factor in terms of him not getting any sort of penalty was that on the last lap, going into turn 3, Acosta had taken the lead going into turn 1, but then Garcia, he was a bit slow coming out. And Garcia drafted him down through 2 and into 3 and pretty much ran into Acosta and pushed him off the track. So I just wonder if race direction kind of saw that as a on as even, you know, so that, because Acosta was definitely pushed off track, Garcia hit him quite hard, in fact. He probably wouldn't have made that corner had Acosta not been in the way. So I think they just kind of gave Acosta a bit of credit for that one. And then when the turn 9 incident happened, although there was no contact between them when that happened, I think they just said, honours even, result stands. And I think that was the right call.
Yep, I do think it was that way too. It was a good call. So basically, Acosta wins the race. Garcia will finish second. Fanati will run third. And then we have Masia, who had a pretty decent ride going. Then Sasaki. Binder would finish sixth. That's as high as he could get with the Honda. Then you had Ramanaka, Cooney, Koffler, Fernandez, Slack, Toba, McPhee, and Guevara, and Suzuki finishing out the top 15. So with that, we can get to the championship standings. Well, with another win, Pedro Acosta now leads on 183 points to 130 points for Sergio Garcia. Fanati, then Foggia, Masia, Binder, Sasaki, Antonelli, Rodrigo, and Alcoba. Anything else, Rich, that we need to add into this for the Moto3 guys?
Just a very atypical Moto3 race for a change. As you said, it was really small packs of riders doing their own thing, really. But pretty much the whole race, quite rightly, you know, the cameras were trained on Acosta and Garcia, who were, you know, giving it everything and pretty much on as even. And fair play to Garcia. I mean, every time Acosta got him, he went straight back through. So, you know, plaudits to him for that. It's just a shame but he's obviously quite a long way back in the points table now. And with Acosta riding the way that he is, it's really hard to see how Garcia's going to make a big championship fight out of it. But he gave a very good account of himself on Sunday. It was a great race. And I'm kind of interested to see if this weekend, if the weather is dry. The forecast at the moment is looking a bit showery again, although we didn't have the deluge that was forecast, you know, last weekend. So
they might get it right this time.
Yeah, they might do. So I'd kind of like to see a dry race in Moto3 to see what they've learned from, you know, the weekend just gone. And, you know, Acosta was clearly very, very fast. But of course, even though they had the wets on by the end of the race, I think that the sort of the big hard braking, swooping kind of lines that he likes to take just wasn't possible because, you know, it was a pretty narrow dry line. So it would be interesting to see if they've got full dry track next week and what will happen. But yeah, it was an interesting game of chess kind of race this time, which made a pleasant change from the norm.
Yep, it was dinner. It was a nice race. Well done. And now we can talk about Moto 2. Now, there'd been 40 minutes ish, I think, from the end of the race in Moto 3 to the Moto 2. So it was going to be declared a dry race. Everyone was going to start on slicks. But we had to look a little bit towards the qualifying of the Moto 2 race, or at least qualifying for the Moto 2 guys. And in that first Moto 2 qualifying session, there was Vietti, Arenas, Roberts there, unfortunately for the American fans, Cambobier, who has problems qualifying, but his race speed is really pretty good. Navarro was in there, and so was DG Antonio. So DG Antonio comes through, Arenas, Manzi, they're all there, and Arenas came through at the end to push out Vietti, so he was not in, so he did not make it through, although he probably should have because he did have some really good pace. As the
They
Moto.
crashed, didn't they, just before the end of the session, I think, Vietti.
Yeah.
So yeah, he sort of scuppered his chance to make it through.
Yep. There was definitely dark clouds on the horizon for that second qualifying session, and there was a question about whether the rain would come or not. By halfway, you had Bezzecchi out front ahead of Gardner, ahead of Adrian Fernandez, Agura, Raul Fernandez, and then Lowe's. Agura came through to actually be on pole, and the question was, would anybody be able to knock him off? Well, the only person who could knock him off was himself because it was a track limits issue, I think, that took his lap, which meant Gardner had pole. Agura was second quick. Actually, I think Gardner came around and took pole, didn't he, from
He
him?
did.
Yeah, I track limits is in the race. Agura then was second, then Bezzecchi, then Raul Fernandez with a good lap there at the end, and then Canet, and then Augusto Fernandez. Lowe's was seventh. Delaporta and then Chantra would finish out your top three rows there in qualifying. So an interesting qualifying session. It was definitely, if it wasn't for Raul Fernandez doing what he does on that bike, I think we'd be talking about Iagura a whole lot more because Iagura has really started to show some great form, and he really did look really quick and settled on that bike. And I was looking for big things to happen for him in the race. With that, we can look at the race in Moto 2. So the question was what was going to go down. And basically, as the whole shot took off, it was Bezzecchi, Gardner, Ogura, and then Raul Fernandez. And then, you had Ogura that was kind of wide at turn three. Roberts crashed at the first couple turns. That was another DNF for Joe Roberts. That's like three on the trot. Again, this guy, he runs hot, he runs cold. And I really thought he
Yeah.
was going to be able to get himself back in the hunt and turn it around here. But again, he doesn't like this track. And it seems like he only does well at tracks that he likes and doesn't do well at tracks that he doesn't like.
Yeah, not good for
Not
him, really.
good. Yeah, he's supposedly still got some people who have got some offers that are there for him to do MotoGP. Now, I'm not sure with who or what, but. I mean, Quartararo never was that successful on a Moto 2 bike, so there's all that possibility that Roberts could jump on one and look great. But Bezzecchi had gone out front. Basically, Iagura had fallen wide, so he was now down to like sixth, fifth or sixth in the list. And then Adrian Fernandez was starting to come on there at the beginning. Remy went to the front, and we've seen Remy do this before. He kind of gets out there, gets to the front, and Remy used his typical Remy Gardner strategy, and that was, hey, here's the pace that I am capable of running. If you would like to come race with me, that's fine, but I'm not hanging around here with you. So Remy's kind of pulling away a little bit. He's got a little bit of time on everybody. Raul Fernandez goes really wide at turn nine. He think he misjudged his braking point maybe a little bit, had to go wide. He lost a lot of places there, so he'd fallen back. And really, it's basically all of a sudden, here comes Canet. He's in the mix, and that was really cool because he came sort of from kind of nowhere, but he had a really good start, so that put him up front. And we've seen flashes of brilliance from Canet on the bike, but never really that much. So after about 10 laps, it's Gardner, it's Canet, it's Bezzecchi, Agura, Adrian Fernandez, Lowe's, and then Raul back there. But Agura now suddenly finds pace. He puts his head down and starts hauling the mail, and he was turning some really, really fast laps there. And then Bezzecchi got by Canet at turn one. Remy was starting to get away, and I think Bezzecchi knew that if he let him get away, he wouldn't have a chance at this at all. So Bisecki said, okay, I'm going to go and I'm going to make a run at it. And with like eight laps to go, Bezecchi was closing in on Gardner. And for whatever reason, Gardner, with six laps to go, screws up at turns four. He just completely misjudged the whole braking thing there. It was weird that because Bezecchi was out front ahead of Gardner by that, at that point, right? And
Well, they were dicing, weren't they?
They were kind of dicing it up. Because
they've been swapping positions a bit, yeah. Gardner, I think it was probably just a bit of a rush of blood to the head, wasn't it? Just broke, you know, a few inches later than would normally do, and yeah, just wasn't going to make the turn.
Yeah, and he wound up going off all the way to the gravel. So that pushed him back, so it was now Bezecchi, Agüero, Canet, Adrian Fernandez, and then Gardner, who got back on ahead of his teammate. But suddenly, Agüero is informed of having a long lap penalty because he had a track limits warning. So they're back, and that's track limit. And he was like, oh, you know, that's the last thing you want to see is Agüero, who's on for a podium, if not a win, because he definitely had pace that would probably have gotten him right to Bezecchi and would have given him a chance in the final couple of laps to maybe take this on. So he has to go to the long lap penalty. He goes through the long lap penalty, and Matt Bird and Dylan Gray are both like, oh, I think he went through the loop too fast. He touched the white lines on the way out. And then it was like, and then the communique came from the officials. No, no, everything's cool with his lap. Okay, great. There's still a chance at this. And he's going after it. But of course, by taking the long lap, that puts him back to fifth. He's actually behind Gardner when he comes out. And then Vietti all of a sudden shows up. He's sixth, who, you know, Vietti had qualified poorly. He had crashed in qualifying. He had come to the front and in a stealth ride because nobody was really talking about him. So he had a great ride coming up to that point. And then all of a sudden, you know, we get to the end of the race and it's like, hey, it's Bezecchi, it's Agüero and Canet, there's your podium. And then it's like, no, you're going to get a 3-second penalty, you know, to Agüero, which basically didn't change anything because he was still going to finish fifth behind Remy because of the long lap. But they did go back and say, yes, you did. So again, you know, what can we say? I'm not sure, but then, you know, a good six for Vietti. Raul Fernandez wound up with seventh and Chantra was eighth, which is a good ride by Chantra as well. So both of the Idemitsu Honda Team Asia bikes were definitely going someplace this weekend. Then Xavi Verhe, Michelle Schroeder, Dixon was 11th, De La Porta, Gigi Antonio couldn't get anywhere with that one. And then Lowe's and Arenas finished out the points scorers. Anything, Rich, we need to, you'd like to discuss further on this?
Yeah, well, I mean, you've described the race very concisely. I think the takeaways for me were two things, really. Vietti, you know, clearly coming on strong after the summer break. We in our half-term report, we were saying he was one of the guys that was a bit disappointing and we would hope to see, you know, some better performance. Well, he certainly delivered it over the weekend. As you said, he was a little bit unlucky in qualifying and had a very strong race. The other guy who for me was outstanding was Adrian Fernandez, Sam Lowe's teammate. And given there's a Yamaha M1 MotoGP bike going at the moment, he's the kind of guy peaking right at the right moment who had a strong few races in the run into the summer break as well. He's putting himself in a pretty strong position to take one of those seats at the Petronas team.
Yep.
Because he's suddenly looking very, very strong.
Yep.
And at the same time, you've got your Roberts and your Lowe's and people just not cutting it and ruling themselves out of that ride, unfortunately for them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So those were the takeaways, really, for me from that race.
Yep. I think Fernandez definitely has to go to MotoGP because with Acosta coming to Moto2, there'd be 237s in there. And, well, we just can't have that. So that's it's all there. Gardner with the championship. Let's look at the championship. Gardner still leads on 197 points. Raul is still second to him on 162. Bezecchi now is actually making a bit of a race for second place. Lowe's is still hanging in there in fourth. Gigi Antonio with the poor ride that he had this weekend is fifth. Then Canet is sixth. Schroeder is seventh. And then Augusto Fernandez, Agüero, and Xavi Verhey running out the top 10. This is definitely Remy's championship, I think, to lose. has not put a foot wrong. We did see a minor flaw today, but that happens to everybody. Even the great have bad days. And if
Yeah.
his worst day is fourth, well, that's still a pretty good day at the office.
And he still hasn't finished outside of the top four all season.
Yeah, that's true.
So that's the consistency that wins championships.
That is right. Consistency is everything, and that is what will win you a championship.
I suppose we should give a quick shout out. Sorry to interrupt,
No, go
but we
ahead.
should give a quick shout out to Bezecchi as well, because he was another of the guys we were kind of lamenting his poor form in the first half of the season. So he showed up looking like a different guy, and he had a nasty crash. A couple of riders had strange crashes coming out of turn three, through the free practice and qualifying days as well. So he picked himself up off the ground a couple of times, I think, over the weekend, Bezecchi. So no, it was a great ride by him.
Yep, I was thrilled to see him win. I really don't want this to be a Raul and a Gardner show the rest of the season. I like to see Bezecchi in there. I'd like to see Lowe's in there as well and see DiGiantonio in there too. Kennett looked really good to me, which I was impressed by the fact that he was going as well as he was on the Bosque Corrida. It shows that it either works or it doesn't, and hopefully they've found something because I would like to see Kennett sort of be there more consistently at the front and hopefully make something out of this, at least set himself up for next year, because I thought that he had the speed and the talent to be a world champion in Moto2, but he did have some crashes when he didn't need crashes, and but that he hasn't really crashed a whole lot in Moto2. He's been a little more methodical maybe in his way to getting up there. So
I think when he's good, he's good. And
yeah.
when he's not so good, he's completely absent, isn't he? He's like quite a few of the riders are. But and he's confirmed into Moto2 on the Kalex in the Pons team, I think, next year. So it'll be interesting to see how, on a more, let's say, sorted or well-regarded chassis in the Formula, see how he does on that. The only other thing I was going to say was Raul Fernandez. You just wonder whether all of the shenanigans going on with contracts and press releases just got into his head a bit. And again, like we had the discussion in the last show, he's a pretty young guy as well, so it's bound to affect your performance, all that going on. So perhaps that was behind, a slightly less stellar performance from him on the day. But he's got another race this weekend at the same track to put that right, so let's see what he can do.
Yep, I think it's a great place to leave Moto2, and we'll go directly to MotoGP qualifying on the Saturday. So in the first MotoGP qualifying session, well, Pedrosa was there, no surprise. Rins was there, Binder was there, Oliveira was there. Now Oliveira, he had a wicked crash that he basically bone bruised his hand, and I think it was his right hand too. So oof, you're trying to brake hard and all that. Pol Espargaró was in there, Rossi was there, and Alex Marquez were all there in it. At the end, it was actually Alex Marquez and Oliveira that wound up going through. Marquez actually looked pretty good on the Honda. For the first time, he sort of showed up and showed us something because it has all been missing since the beginning of the year. So kudos for him to making it through and, looking pretty well on the bike was he did it as well. So kudos to that. In the second qualifying session, there was craziness involved. Marquez crashed at turn three and he was sort of all over the place in that session. Quartararo was on pole and his last lap got canceled because he exceeded the track limits at turn nine. And that was because he had chased down Jorge Martin to try to beat his lap for pole, but because that lap got taken away, Martin wound up being on pole. So this is another pole for Martin. This is only his sixth time on the Ducati because he sat out for a month after the crash at Portugal, and he's already got two poles, which is amazing in that regard. He somehow can make the Ducati bend where others cannot. And it is amazing to watch him ride. It is really, really interesting. Could be the fact too that the Ducati is fast at that track, but man, I give Martin credit in the 6-7 right left, left right flop flop there. He is quick through that section. And even Ben Yaya said that he needed to go study his data because he was very fast in that area. Ben Yaya would go on to be second. He would beat Quartararo's time. Quartararo was in start on third. So Yamaha on the front row is not a bad deal at all for the Yamaha for Quartararo. He's super stoked to be there. Then you had Miller. Then you had Juan Mir on the Suzuki, who on Friday night got a box of parts from Hamamatsu that gave him a shape-shifting motorcycle. The bike was now
Christmas came early.
squat. And he put that to great use. They bolted it on in an all-nighter on Friday night, thanks to Matt Oxley's article in Motorsports Magazine. And he went out there and got it onto the second row, which Skyler and I have said this a long time. You have to be in the first two rows if you're going to win a MotoGP race. Just that's where you have to be. Rounding out was Zarco, Espargaró, Aleix Espargaró, not pole. Then Marc Marquez, eighth. Vinales, Nakagami. Alex Marquez, 11th. And then Oliveira, I think he put in one lap maybe on there. He was definitely feeling the effects of that earlier crash. Get to Sunday's race. The race is dry. It goes to start, and we wind up getting into that mysterious turn three, and we have a huge crash involving one Mr. Danny Pedrosa and the Aprilia of Salvadore. Now, it appeared that Pedrosa was coming out of three. He kind of spun up the back end and sort of low-sided himself around on maybe a cold tire a little bit, potentially. But he was then left facing oncoming traffic with everybody trying to avoid him, which they did, thankfully. But the person who avoided Danny, but not the bike, was Juan Salvadori. Well, that sharp impact was his front wheel to the fuel tank of Pedrosa's KTM, and that cracked the fuel tank. And we all know what happens when you have high octane fuel on a hot exhaust of a motorcycle. It burns. So there was this huge fireball of an Aprilia and a KTM burning themselves to death there on the track. It immediately called for a red flag. I was obvious. The Salvadori was taken to the medical center. He was definitely hobbling around. I think he may have hurt his ankle, either severely sprained it, or maybe potentially broke one or two bones. And I never got an answer as to what he had. But let's be thankful they were not life-threatening injuries there at all. The race was delayed for about 20 minutes, I think, as they tried to clean up from where the fire was and all that good stuff. So that allowed Pedrosa to actually start on his spare bike. So he was able to get back into the race. And we kind of did it all over again from that big crash. So one thing we need to think about too here is in the first start, at the first turn, Mark that is, sort of dive bombed in on poor old Aleix Espargaró and knocked him wide. And they both wound up running wide in that first turn. Now, that incident, because there's a second one coming on the second start, it was like deja vu, right, Rich? Like, I thought I'd seen
It
this
was.
before.
There were two or three things that were deja vu about the two
Exactly.
race starts, but you carry on.
So on the second start, the same thing kind of happens again, only this time Marquez got pinched on the inside with no gap. So he really didn't have anywhere he could have gone on the second one. The first one was, let's just put that one as to being a little bit too aggressive there. That was just a bit much. I think Marquez knew he needed to get to the front if he wanted to stay with the guys in the front. I think he had pace to be in that 4, 5, 6 area, but he wasn't able to show it because of that. The restart was basically a carbon copy with Martin getting to the front. This time, though, Ben Yaya didn't have anywhere near the start that he had the first time, and he sort of just fell away with absolutely nowhere. And I guess I should mention that Vinales, they did the quick restart method. So you had 60 seconds to get out of the pit lane. You have your mechanic on the grid. You pull up to that mechanic. He checks to be sure everything's A-OK. They walk off, they start the race. Well, when Vinales had got to that point, he stalled his bike. So he had to push it off the grid, get it restarted, and was able to start from the pit lane. So he already had a problem. So again, Vinales, who is very much linked to the Aprilia ride, to the point where he even said that, hey, since there's these other Yamaha rides on there, why would I want to ride a Yamaha? Which means that it says to me that he actually has an Aprilia contract in his pocket. So who knows what's going to happen there? But the race then is Martin out front, and who's coming hard, but basically Mir, who's had a good start. That's Suzuki showing that it can run with it. And you know, the track suits Mir's style. Deep, hard braking, good corner stability, which is the Suzuki has in spades. And now you can see the shapeshifter. He was able to run with Martin. And that was fascinating. Here we are. There's a guy who was saying, hey, I need these parts. I need them. The factory delivers on a Friday night special, and he puts it to like the ultimate use. Like, you, as an engineer, you design something, you test it, and you say, well, it's going to give us 2 tenths, 3 tenths, 4 tenths, whatever that magic number is that you think it's going to give you. And then you hope, because racing is different than any kind of testing or any kind of wind tunnel data or whatever you have, because it's feel and susceptibility to what you're doing and all the other things that are out there. And it worked like a champ. And Mir was right with Martin the whole entire time. Somewhere along the way, Miller was racing hard, but he wound up trash in the front. I think he was trying to keep up with Martin and trying to do things with the Ducati that Martin can do, but he can't do. So that was off into the grass there again. So we had that. We get towards the end, and you could tell Quartararo had kind of just decided he was going to settle for third. There was nowhere that he was going to go. Third was going to be good on the day. If you told him earlier on in the week he'd get third in the race, I think he would have told you that we'd be lucky to be in the top five. So I think he would take a podium without anything. But as the race wore on, basically Jorge Martin ran a flawless race, withstood all the pressure that Juan Mir threw at him, and wound up winning his first MotoGP race. I think it's the first race win for Pramac. It's the first
Yep, it is.
satellite Ducati to win a race as well. So that was just special beyond special. Mir now took some points off Quartararo, because I think this might be the first time that he actually finished ahead of him. So you had that. Then you had Brad Binder, who had an amazing ride from deep in his qualifying spot. He is a Sunday man of all Sunday men. He's got that Sunday Rossi magic in him. He was way up there at the end of the race. He had actually made his way to fourth. And with a few laps, he might have gotten Quartararo for the podium, showing that maybe he can ride the KTM as well as Oliveira can. And the other thing that was there that was amazing was Zarco. Zarco showed up, never really had much going on at all weekend, but he somehow salvaged the sixth to basically keep himself in the title hunt. Again, Quartararo wasn't taking maximum points, so you know, damage limitation on Zarco's side. Again, very well done there. And then the mysterious case at Francisco Bagnaia, who went absolutely nowhere in that race, and you come to find out he got basically a bum tire, is how he's put it, which is weird in a controlled tire situation like this. To get a bum one is definitely odd. Now, there's other things that could be associated with this. Could have lost a wheel weight, could have spun on the rim, gone out of balance. Any of those things are possible. We just heard that it was a tire issue that kept him in the back there. But that's how things finish, with Martin winning first, his very first race, I should say. Then Mir, Quartararo, Binder, Nakagami had a great race. Again, this has been like somehow a guy that we said had to get better, got better, and made the Honda look decent. And then Zarco wins. Marquez would finish eighth in what was a very ragged and sloppy race from the 8-time world champion, which is there. His brother was right behind him to finish ninth. Pedrosa finished 10th. I mean, Danny Pedrosa, 995 days away from racing, and he comes to finish 10th on there, which, you know, he was helped by a little bit of attrition, I'm not gonna lie. But still fantastic to see Dana get that far up. And then Bagnaia, Bastianini, Rossi finished 13th, Luca Marini and Lecuona earned a point in 15th. Rich, I know you got something to add to this one. Let me hear it.
Well, yeah, it was a compelling race, wasn't it? I all weekend after that shapeshifter got fitted onto Mir's bike, the guy just looked joyous.
He did.
His smile, just transformative for
yeah
him, and he's showing that with the equipment, to equal equipment in terms of that kind of technology, as much as we hate it, but he's got it and he made good use of it. Rins was a bit curious over the weekend. He apparently was struggling to adapt to using the device, I believe. But one of the deja vu elements of the two starts was that Rins had a rocket start on both occasions, because he was starting back in, I forget where we said he qualified, but it was somewhere around
Oh, he
14th,
never
I
even made it
think.
out of P1.
No, and so, but he was up to eighth on both of the starts. So again, I mean, okay, that's the whole shot device, I guess, off the line, perhaps. But you know, it was a better race from Rins, but totally overshadowed by Mir. But it was really all about the Jorge Martin show, really, wasn't it? I mean, the guy who's still not fully fit from those injuries he sustained in Portugal several rounds ago. Yeah, just a sensational performance all around, really. Great for Pramac to get their first win. War of words going on still in the press, I think, between Marquez and Espargaró. I think Espargaró, he's kind of pulled out. It didn't look like a bike failure, and he certainly didn't crash. He was kind of holding on to his side. So I wonder whether or not he got, you know, a couple of proper thumps, you know, in his ribs or something. The first one was clearly Marquez's
Oh, yeah.
fault, just going in way too hot. You're right, in the second start, when the same thing kind of happened again, he was kind of in a squeeze point between Quartararo and Espargaró, and kind of didn't have anywhere to go. But clearly, Espargaró probably didn't see it that way.
No,
So again,
no.
it might be tasty between those two next weekend.
Yeah, I think that, you know, in the after the interview, Marquez did put the blame on himself for the first one.
He
He, you
did,
know,
yeah.
he did say that. He said, you know, there was a gap. The gap closed a lot faster than I thought, and I punted him. The second one, he's like, well, hey, I really had nowhere to go, so the contact was going to be inevitable. To his part, Elise came in and said, yeah, that first one was a bit crazy. Yeah, it's your fault. That was a bit over the limit. I mean, yes, it very much was. I think in those instances, at the beginning of the starts, and they're chaotic, and what happens, I think you have to kind of let that one go. If Marquez had put Aleix on the ground, then I think you're looking at maybe a long lap penalty. I think
Yeah.
there's a distinction there that you can easily make, and I think most people would agree with that one. But Aleix took the high road on the second one, and he did. He said, you know, I haven't seen it, and I'm not too worried about it. So we'll see how long this goes. I'm sure there's going to be a Twitter feud this week.
Yeah, they take a sort of a bit of a lenient view, I think, on the first few corners of a you know a lap one, don't they, with these incidents. But Mark was a little bit, yeah, ragged all weekend, as you said.
He was.
The only other things I was going to add really was that, you know, Brad Binder, if only he could qualify.
Oh, yes, totally.
Because, as you say, he really is Rossi reincarnated in terms of Sunday performance. Because Rossi's never been renowned for good qualification. Okay, the first couple of seasons on the RCV when, you know, the four strokes arrived, but that bike was so far superior to everything else that he couldn't really do anything but be on pole. I was super impressed with Zarco for celebrating with the team. Martin up on the podium. I thought that was a nice touch from him, because that must have been a bit gutting from his point of view, because he's yet to win a MotoGP race, I think, Zarco. So yeah, plaudits to him for that. And then the only other thing that came out, which you may have heard, was that Joan Mir, who's 23, was the oldest guy on the podium.
I did not hear that one, but
Goes
that's,
back to our conversation last week,
yeah.
but and it's a yeah sobering thought that at 23 he's the senior guy out of the three of those those boys. So yeah,
That's wild.
what a world. But yeah, so it was pleased. Obviously, everybody would immediately feared the worst down at turn three, you know, for that corner. I mean, it's going to get changed probably, as we said earlier on. But you know, that crash, that incident could have happened at
Anywhere.
pretty much any turn,
And that's what,
anywhere in
and
the world.
Dylan Gray was on that immediately. He's like, this is not the Red Bull Ring's problem. This was a any racetrack problem. It wasn't specific to that layout, although they're going to make a change. I think they're going to have to. I think Red Bull's got enough money that they don't really care. But
Let's not forget that although it wasn't a wet race in the end, and you know, the dire forecast of torrential rain and thunderstorms and stuff never came to pass, but quite a number of the riders were saying that if it was very bad conditions, they weren't going to race. And I suppose turn three, with its recent history, just sort of feeds into that worry about bikes. Because, you know, we see these bikes racing at the speeds that they go at, and you know, they break so ferociously, these things. It's only when you see a bike out of control, like we saw last year, that you realize the sheer velocity of these things. And in the wet, that track is sketchy. There's no doubt. And if bikes were going down just because you just can't keep the front, going into a braking area, then it is tricky, that track. But it does make me wonder why they're racing there twice. Again, surely they could have raced twice somewhere else, but who knows?
I think it's convenient. I think there's like a low COVID risk there. Obviously
Yeah,
they obviously
maybe.
Red
Yeah.
Bull has the money. I think it's they've put a lot of money into the sport, so I think it's a thank you to Dorna.
Yeah, maybe. But there are lots of the riders very vocal about it. And one of the most vocal, I have to say, was Cal Crutchlow, who was being really quite rude about the place. But there you go. We'll see what happens next weekend.
I think so. I think that about does it for the show, Rich, because we got to go back at this again next week. We'll be at the same place. I'm sure probably the same time we'll be back again to talk about this one, and I'm sure it's going to be another fantastic one. So until then, everybody, zoom, zoom.